so it's time to introduce our main speaker tonight, and let's give a warm welcome to Fred C. of Santa Barbara.
All right, my name is Fred. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. It's Alcoholics Anonymous, right?
Yep.
All right, we're going to get this over real quick. Just don't drink no matter what. All right, let's go. I wish it was that easy. If it was that easy, I wouldn't be here. Man, this is always hard, getting up here in front of people and trying to speak. I start getting nervous, and I start shaking, and I start stuttering, and I just got to relax and just start talking about normal stuff, like motorcycles. And actually, this is the second time that Tom's invited me up. I guess I spoke at some other club, the
1600 Club or something?
Yeah, 1600 Club, and it was great. We had a good time. This is a cool club, too. You know, you got the one day at a time, 12 steps start here. Get a sponsor. That's good for you. Paul, don't cut and run. I don't know about that one. Keep coming back. It's always good. Surrender to win. Easy does it. That's some good stuff, man. This is a good club. I like it. I'd like to support the people who came here to support me tonight, Tristan, Brian, Jason, Lindsay. And last week I was at a meeting with Jason and Lindsay in Goleta, and it was a speaker meeting. And the speaker, just real quickly, he mentioned that he wasn't a booze fighter. And I just recently got this book, it's the wild one about the original booze fighters that took over Hollister, California. And in the book it says, a booze fighter, meant for a man with a drinking problem or an alcoholic. I like that. Okay. I'm just trying to keep rolling and don't let the fear set in, you know? Because once that sits in, I'm gone. I'm running. I got my big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with me because my opinion doesn't mean shit. It doesn't matter. It's all about this book and working out of it. This is a little strange because it's red. It's the study edition. So in it, they give you all the things in a normal big book, but you also get pages to take notes and write in, and they give you the original manuscript in the back, and there's also a dictionary of all the words that are used in the book. It's helped me out a lot. Actually, I just started using this one because I got this the third edition big book, and I'll be up here trying to share something out of the book with you guys, and it'll spill out all over the floor. And that's kind of embarrassing when I'm picking up pages and not reading them. Let's see what the book says. All right, so we go to the doctor's opinion. And it's talking about Bill here, and it says, in the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning the possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 other appeared to have recovered from alcoholism. So, I came in here, I was hopeless. I was shaken, I was drunk, I had urine-stained Levi's, and I had no answers. I had no way out. I had no idea what was going to happen. But the first and most important thing I could have done in my recovery was I stuck my hand out and I asked for help. I said, my name's Fred, I'm an alcoholic. Can you help me? And I got it. I was surrounded with people trying to do exactly what that guy said. They were trying to impress on me the message that this book and others carry. God, I feel so weird because it's red. So, about me. I come from Goleta.
Goleta!
And I was adopted and adopted by a couple that's older than most people's parents. Doesn't really matter. That doesn't really make me an alcoholic one way or another. But for me, as an adopted only child, it put a lot of pressure on me. I was really embarrassed of my home life, my family life, my parents. You know, because they were older and kids would come over. They'll be like, let's go over to your house. And I'd bring them over. And they'd be like, is that your grandparents? And I'd be like, oh, my God. You know, they're out there like chain smoking and playing cards and stuff. And I didn't get it. I didn't like it. You know, that's the only, I can't change my parents. That's it. You know, I only got the one set. So if you're going to be hanging out with me, you're not coming over to my house. And I'm not letting you. So, you know, that was, it was like that type of fear of an anxiety and embarrassment of something that I could not change. And I would take every opportunity, every chance I could to hang out with other kids in the neighborhood and do other things that didn't involve my parents. And so you hopefully wouldn't get a sign of my fear and embarrassment. And early on, around 12, the next door neighbor family, they had a kegerator, you know, like the. And we started sneaking little Dixie cups full of beer out of this kegerator. He really didn't do anything. But one time, the old man, the neighbor's old man, used to stick Bud Talls around that ice cold keg. And we took these two Bud Talls and we took them down to the field, which was more mesa. And you know, we cracked them open, we slammed back these two Bud Talls, and you know, everyone's different. You know, some speakers will say nothing happened, no lights happened, no flashing buzzers or whatever, but something happened for me. You know, I was 12 years old and that alcohol had an effect on me. I was okay with Fred Conrad and the old parents at that moment. I was okay, you know, and I got all warm and I eyes glassed over and everything was okay. And that's, you know, before that I was just introduced to alcohol and the taste. But at this point I was introduced to the reaction that I have to it. And it was phenomenal. So, you know, I made a promise to myself that I was gonna start hanging out around that kegerator. And you know, at 12 years old, you know, you're scraping and you're scrounging, doing what you can to get by. And I think that was also the introduction of my alcoholism to my parents, because that's when they started seeing me coming home at odd hours, coming home like this and slurring my words and stuff. And I remember the first night that I really got really smashed was this older surfer kid in the neighborhood was having a party, and he told me, hey, yeah, why don't you come by later? And so I rode over to the party on my mom's 3-speed Schwinn, and I come in there, and there's all these older surfer kids with these high school chicks, and I'm just like, oh, you know, like the young kid, and everyone's like, oh, whatever. And so the guy hands me a screwdriver. Well, actually, he hands me the glass, and I'm like, what's this? And he's all, it's a screwdriver. And I'm like, what's a screwdriver? He's all, just drink it, man. And so I drank it, and that same effect that happened in the field at Mor Mesa with the Bud Tall was happening again. And I loved it. And so I asked for another and another and another, and I was flying. I was like king of the party that night, like grabbing chicks' butts. Kind of got out of hand. And so that's when we still had golf and fun. It was a local skate park and miniature golf and arcade and whatnot. And we went over there, and I was in the midst of a blackout, and I guess I got in a fight with a couple pinball machines, and a couple bouncers or a couple people that worked there kicked me out, and you know, I think they just put me in the car, and I was like trying to sleep it off in the car, and the next thing I remember was they got me home, and they rolled me up to my parents' house in a shopping cart, and I rang the bell. And then, you know, so that's how my parents find me. They're, you know, their only adopted son just smashed in the shopping cart. And no, it wasn't me. And the same way my drinking started was the same way it ended. It started with a puke bowl and a gallon of water. My mom set me up with a puke bowl and a gallon of water. And you know, I took full advantage of both of those. So, you know, early on I started getting the talking to's and the sitting downs, and you know, I have this really short, mean, gruff old man, and he's scary. And he'd be all, "Did anybody force you to drink it? Did they force you to drink it? Did they twist your arm?" And I'd be all, "No." He's like, you know, and I always remember that. You know, did anybody force you to drink it? No, I want to drink it. I love to drink it. And so you know, it's just a downhill spiral of shit like that, of you know, getting rides home from the cops, coming home black and blue. You know, you turn 16. I turn 16. I get this beat up Datsun 610, and within a week, I got the back window smashed out at some party. And so then I'm driving around with, like, you know, the cardboard back window and all sorts of profanity written back there. And but that was all right. You know, I didn't care. You know, 16, what are you going to do? So I think, like, the first month of my 17th, age 17, I got my first DUI. And, you know, at that age, you think you're fearless. You're invincible. Nothing, you know, you're just in love with alcohol and finding the party and, you know, trying to be cool. And I ended up, you know, we're driving around with a 12-pack, open, drinking, driving, whatever. And then, you know, I ended up, like, hitting this middle divider in this neighborhood and just, like, blowing out both tires on the car, blah, 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 blah. Anyways, so, you know, I got introduced to AA. And so in Goleta, I was brought up at this Goleta Valley Community Center. I went to like kindergarten through third grade there, and then I had to start serving whatever it was called, my public service or whatever. It wasn't SWAP, it was just community service. There we go. And you know, in the same room that I'd seen all sorts of punk bands, you know, I was now mopping up and looking at that stage and thinking about, you know, seeing all these bands and having a great time in there, like dancing around all smashed and stuff, and you know, and then I'm in there mopping the floor, and it didn't matter, you know, because at that point, you know what it's like. Nothing is gonna take away our drinking. Nothing's gonna interrupt that. Nothing. Doesn't matter. You know, I was 17. I didn't stop drinking until I was 33. So it just went on and on and on and on like that, and you know, I would move out and come back and move out and come back, and I don't know. And then turning 21, I turned 21, and I used to skate up to Monty's bar in this Magnolia Shopping Center. You know, nothing better than that. let's refer back to the book. Let's see. Oh, you know, I was asked to speak here tonight, and you know, Bill, early on in his recovery, later he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients. Here, with some misgiving, we gave the consent. So he was asking for the privilege. Hey, you know what? Can I talk to some of your guys and tell them what I found? You know, I was asked to come here. It's a privilege to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. But it seems like, you know, it's almost reversed around. Like we stand back on the sidelines and wait for someone to ask us when we should be offering our services. You know, hey, do you got a sponsor? Can I help you out? Can I speak here tonight? Sure. So moving around, changing locations, you know, San Francisco to San Diego, San Diego to Sonoma. Nothing really changed, but The drinking just kept going, and alcoholism is a progressive disease. And during all that mayhem and chaos, the only thing that stayed consistent was the progression of my disease. At one point, I had moved back to Santa Barbara, and I was living with this girlfriend and her mom on the east side, and her mom was a nurse. And this was like at the tail end of my drinking, and it was really starting to, it was, well, you know, how bad can it get? It was, you know, it was just, it was such a struggle just to wake up, just to get out of that bed and to go to work. Because what I would do was I would get up shaking violently at like 4 a.m, grab a beer and go back and try and sleep till 6. And then get out of bed and put the pants on backwards, and then the girlfriend would be all, "You going to work, baby?" And I'd be all, yeah. And, you know, that's not what happened. I would get in that truck, and I would drive down to the Mecca. And, you know, I'd be there before the bartender, just like, "Oh, open up." And, you know, it was, you know, it went on like that for I don't know how long. And, like, the girlfriend would come home, and she'd be like, "How'd work go today?" And I'd be like, "Oh, God, oh, I worked so hard." And she'd be like, "Oh, I seen your truck behind the Mecca." And, you know, that's what we do. We gotta protect and isolate the drinking and the disease, because you're not getting anywhere near it. And, you know, the weekend would come around, and she'd be all, "What are we going to do tonight, baby?" And I'd be all, "I ain't doing nothing with you." God, that sucks, huh? And then she'd be all, "Well, what are you going to do?" And I'd just be all, "I'm going to drink." And I would just waddle my ass down to the bar and just drink as much beer as I could. And if there was a day where I made it through a full day of work, you know, I would, that lunch break would come around, and it's a half hour, and I would blast up to the Mecca again and drink as many beers as I could in 45 minutes, even though we had a half hour lunch break. And, you know, before I was just all, "Oh my God," and then I'd come back just, you know, "Everything's cool," thinking like, you know, I'm pulling this off, no one knows, I got it. But, you know, the whole time everyone knew, you can't. So, I started showing up. I had the keys to this silkscreen place, and it was my responsibility to open up the joint, get the dryers going, blah, blah, blah. And I would start showing up there and doing that stuff, and I would leave a little note there. Like, "Oh, my God, I'm so sick." You know, I would do that for like 2 weeks at a time. And then one time my boss said, "Oh, you know what? You know, you gotta bring a doctor's excuse. You know, we gotta find out what's going on here." So I went to a... We got a message here. People always leave like that? Yeah. God, that hurts my feelings. So I show up this kind of one of those day clinics. You just walk in and you tell them you got the shits, and, you know, they check your breath and like, "Oh, God, I ate some bad tacos at Fiesta or something." So this guy gives me a written doctor's excuse. I'm like, "Here you go." And I was off and running again. I pulled it off. Everything was cool. But, you know, it wasn't much longer, and I just couldn't take it. I just couldn't take, like, the games and just... Well, what the main fear was not being able to drink. And so one more time, I had opened up that silkscreen shop and left that note, and I was downtown, and I'm like, you know, I want some closure to this or whatever. And I called up my boss, and I'm like, "Hey, you know, thanks for everything. It's not going to work out. I got another job. Thanks." And but I didn't. I didn't have a job. I had just quit that one just because the only thing I wanted to do was to drink. And I was on my way. And I felt good after that. I had no more responsibilities, you know. Not really. And then I think it was that same day I was doing my State Street crawl. You know, I'd start off at the Mecca, then hit the Mel's and the Sportsman, and then start going down, and then kind of work my way back up, if you're all familiar with State Street. I think it was that day that I was going to just sit down. I was just going to take a little rest just for a little while on State Street, and I sat down on some, like, fountain or something, and I passed out there. I passed out on State Street. These like three lowrider guys come up to me, and anything could have happened. This is like in the middle of the day. They could have just taken my wallet, my keys, and just left. You know, anything could have happened. So like, they're getting me into this car, and I'm just so obliterated. I got no idea what's going on. I'm like, I can't even talk to them. They're like, and I remember the one guy saying, he's like, "Hey man, you think you got a problem with alcohol?" And I'm like, "Whoa, I don't know." And then they try to, they're all, we're gonna take you home, man. And I'm like, I couldn't even tell them where I live. All I could do was like, it's over here. And whenever I tell that little story, I always wonder if those same three guys have seen me around. If they're out there going, "Hey man, there's that guy, remember him?" You know? Damn, if you guys ever want a really good story time, you gotta get this guy back up here. Fukala chingao. He was telling me some of it on the way up here was good. Thanks for coming with me. I somehow got home that night, and just a vicious circle, vicious cycle, whatever you want to call it. And I remember I had this great scheme. It's like, all right, tonight I'm not gonna drink till 11 p.m. Because what my problem is I start drinking too early, and then I'm the endurance drinker, and I just gotta drink all day. Yeah, I'm not gonna stop until I'm out. So I'll just start later. So I started at 11, and what happened? You know, I'm just like watching the clock. I got there, go. And I got hammered more that night than I did from like drinking all day in the hot sun. And then like, I was smart enough to call a cab. I'm surprised I could even get a cab. And this cab driver gets me to my house, and he's like, "Hey man, let me help you up to the front steps." And I'm like, "Oh, look out, I got it." And like, you know, I'm seeing like triple, quadruple, and I try to get up on the curb, and I miss it, and like just go face first down onto the curb, and like bust my nose, get this nice scar here, and could have like caved in my full grill, and so I get up off of that, and I'm like, oh my god, and I come to the front door, and the girlfriend's mom is standing there, and she just starts screaming, "Ah!" You know, I look like something out of The Exorcist. And, I just get out of my way, woman. And, I just go in there and just, like, just face first down on the bed. And wake up the next morning, and I'm like, oh, you know, I get up, and the pillow's stuck to the face, and I pull that off. Ooh, that was a rough one. And then, I go into the bathroom, and I'm just all, oh, my God. You know, like, heads out to here, nose is over there, black eyes, looking good. And I only got one answer, man. So what do? That's it, man. You know, I'm back down at the Mecca and I'm sitting there drinking with this guy, and I look over, and he's an old street urchin guy, just you know, career drinker, street crawler. And I look over, and he's got the same scar as me. And he gives me one of these, he's all. I'm like, oh, whoa. And in a split second, I'm like, oh, that's me. That's going to be me. As I, you know, finish another bud. Time marches on, and I just keep going. I keep going. And let's go back to the book here for a second. All right, nothing's coming up yet. I don't know, one more time, I'm coming off like a 7-day run, and I only got one answer, man. I only got one medicine. And I'm just like, oh my God, I'm shaking, and it's so bad. And I get down to the Mecca, and I'm like, you know, it's all I can do just to get the lid off that Budweiser. And that clock's not moving. You guys check that? So I get that thing open, and I'm trying to pull it off. I'm just like trying to be like, shit's going everywhere, beer's foaming over, and man, I couldn't finish that beer. I started getting lockjaw, and everything was seizing up on me. I could not finish that beer, and it was all I could do. It took every ounce of energy, and you know, mental strength to stand up and walk out of that bar. Not because I wanted to drink, but because I physically could no longer move or drink. I was hemorrhaging. I was having some seizure. And And I walked, I was vertical out of that bar, and then I just dropped as soon as I got out in the back of the parking lot. And I crawled up to my house, like 4 blocks, on my hands and knees, soiled myself, and was, you know, walked up to that lady's house again, or crawled, and she sees me in the kitchen, and this lady's a nurse, man. You know, she sees alcoholism and alcoholics every day, and she knows what to look for. So at that point, she says, "Fred, I think you got a problem with alcohol. And if you don't do something about it, I'm going to have to kick you out." Now, on one side, that's not that big a threat. You know, for an alcoholic, it's like, you know, take it on the heel and toe, man. I'll roll wherever, man. Renegade! And so, but I don't know, you know, the big book talks about it, and, you know, the Pulp Fiction talks about it. It's like, at that point in my drinking, I had what the alcoholics call a moment of clarity. It was more than crystal clear to me at that point, if I didn't do something about this, that I was going to die of untreated alcoholism. Right there, it was that clear, boom. And I had, you know, I was just coming off a 7-day bender, and I couldn't keep a clear thought in my head if you paid me. But when that lady said those words, it blocked out everything else. And it was as clear as you guys are sitting here that I was going to die of alcoholism. At that time, I had guys getting sober around me. I had like 2 or 3 guys my age getting sober around me. And I made a phone call. I made a phone call to this guy named Mike. And this guy had the heart like the size of a canned ham. He would do anything for you. I used to call this guy up in like a drunken rage, and I would make him come pick me up and drive me to the bar, and he didn't drink. And then I would sit there and I would make him drink with me. I mean, how do you make an amends for something like that? And anyway, so I called that guy up, and I'm like, "Oh, Mike, I need some help. I want to try this thing. Can you take me to a meeting?" And he couldn't. He was already involved with something that night. Mike called a second guy. The second guy had just gotten out of knee surgery. He was unavailable to come get me. The second guy called a third guy. This third guy showed up at my house, and he's just like, "You know, I'm here from Alcoholics Anonymous to see Fred. You know, I don't know this man. I know Mike, who I originally called. I don't know this guy." Anyways, I'm like the flying X in the middle of the carpet. And he's like, "Oh, you know," he introduced himself, and he got me in his car. He's like, "Let's go to my house. Let's go talk." So I was ready. I was ready at that point. And he got me in his car, and I didn't even get 2 blocks down the road. I'm like, "Oh, you got to pull over." And I opened the door and puked my life out all over the street there. And he's like, "Oh, no big deal." And he just handed me like a napkin, and we kept rolled down to his house. And we sat up till 3 in the morning that night, you know, pissing, crying, talking about AA, talking about his drinking, talking about how he was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he worked it straight out of this book, straight out of, like, chapter 7. If you read that, it's incredible. You know, he worked it word for word. He let me control the conversation. If I wanted to talk about drinking, he let me. If I was in a light mood, he let me laugh about it. If I was sad, he let me cry. 3 o'clock in the morning rolled around, and he said, "Fred, you know what? I got to get some sleep." Out came the jug of water and the puke bowl, and he set me up on his couch. He's like, "Oh, you try to get some sleep, and I'm gonna get you up in the morning. We're gonna go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." I'm all right. At that point, I had some cut off army pants and a leather jacket, and looking good. So, you know, I made use of both those items that night, and we got up the next morning, and it was in August, and it was one of those mornings where it was like 9:30, and it was just gray and misty, and that June gloom, whatever, and you couldn't tell what time of day it was all day. And you know, we're walking down to his car, and he's all, "I got some bad news for you." I'm like, "Oh, well, nothing could be worse than the way I'm feeling right now." He's all, "Well, last night, Mike died," and that's the guy that I had originally called. And I'm like, oh, what are you talking about? I just talked to him like a few hours ago. He's all, yeah, well, between the time that you called him and now, he died. And that night, Mike, you know, being the guy with the canned ham heart, he was he was so hell-bent on keeping you happy. He got involved with some guys, and he was doing some drinking. He was mixing prescription drugs with no non-prescription drugs, and he overdosed. He passed. They found him blue the next morning. So I'm rolling down to the Solano Club. Things are going through my head. I'm like DTing. I'm sweating. I'm shaking. My friend just died, and I don't know. What am I going to do? I sit down in these chairs like you guys have here tonight, and they ask if the... if we have any newcomers here tonight, and to stand up and identify yourself so we can get to know you better. So I stand up and I said, you know, my name's Fred, I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, I'd been to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't mention that I had two other DUIs after that first one, because I guess it doesn't really matter, but I attended a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never heard nothing. Nothing. I didn't want to hear nothing. You know what? I want to get in there and get your signature and get the hell out of there. And but that day I heard something. In the state that I was in, I was drinking, I was DTing, sweating, and shaking, and you know, I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard this thing works. And I seen examples of it working in other people's lives, like yourself. And that night, or that day, my guy took me home, and on the way home, I asked him about sponsorship. I knew a little bit about it because my friends had been getting sober around me, like I said, and I'd heard that word sponsor and, you know, what kind of happens and stuff, and I get sponsored. And you know what? I can't do this on my own. Self cannot fix self. Left up to myself, I'm doomed. I can't do shit. I can barely do shit right now by myself. So I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he's like, oh yeah, you know, I'd love to sponsor you. And he kind of explained to me how it works and stuff. I'm within my first 12 hours of trying not to drink. I'm not gonna say sobriety, but I just haven't had a drink yet. And he's like, I got some simple stuff for you. And one is, I want you to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day, and I want you to call me every day. Real simple stuff, Fred. Think you can handle it? Yeah. I just ripped off a tin. And some of these we balked. Right out of the gate. I don't know. So, out of the gate, I'm balking, and I'm like, I'm all, every day? And he's like, yeah, every day. And I'm like, before the job, which I didn't have, before the girlfriend I was about to lose, and before the motorcycle that I was physically unable to ride at this point, he's like, oh, yeah, Fred, if you don't put this thing first, if you don't put AA first, you're not going to have any of that stuff, because you're going to be dead. They need one of those up there. You're going to be dead. He also asked me two questions that I later found out were in this book. And, I didn't know if he was making them up, but it's nice to find out that they come out of our text. He asked me if I had a willingness, if I had an honest desire to stay sober. I said, yeah. Next, he asked if I was willing to go to any lengths, real simple, any lengths to have victory over alcohol. And I'm all, whoa. I pictured myself on top of his house, re-roofing his house or something. And he's all, no, Fred, no. Any lengths is just, you know, doing what you can. If someone asks you to do perform a service in AA, you do it. If somebody asks you for help, you help them. How it works, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Real simple, as some of these we balked. So I agreed, even though I was still kind of questioning the any lengths. You know, I wasn't sure. I wasn't buying the whole package. Another miracle happened right then was this guy is the whole basis of AA to me, and he still is. He's not my sponsor anymore, but you know, when I think of sponsorship and sobriety, I think of this man and his unconditional love for both me and Alcoholics Anonymous. He was taking me home, and in the condition I was in, he just looks over, and you know, he told me that we're gonna go to another meeting that same night. He's like, I'm gonna pick you up at 7, and I'm gonna take you to another meeting. He's all, but in the meantime, let's go home and get you cleaned up. And something changed right then too. It was like I'm shaking and I'm DTing, but I'm hearing certain stuff. I'm hearing the love. I'm hearing the help. He said, let's go home and get you cleaned up. He didn't say, call me after you shower. Why don't you go home and shave? You know, call me when you don't stink so bad. None of that. You know, I got a lot of that from the bartenders, but he wasn't having it. He took me home. He grabbed some clean clothes for me, put me in the shower, and needless to say, I slept most of that day until, you know, I got his phone call, and I was directed to get ready for the next meeting, and that's what I did. And I went to that second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard the message again, loud and clear. We got home from the meeting that day, and I was directed to start reading this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and at this point, you know, I maybe had like 12 hours of sobriety, or I don't even know if it's that. And I had read in the doctor's opinion, right here, I'm sitting at this breakfast table, and I'm shaking, and I'm sweating, and the words are flying off the page, and I'm like, trying to keep it together. But I want this thing. I want what this man offers. This is what it said. It says, we believe and so suggested that a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average tempered drinker. These allergic types, that's me, can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost all their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them, and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. These guys are following me around. But it told me what happens, and it gave me the answer, too. It said, I can never safely use alcohol in any form. You know, I didn't understand that till years later. I just thought it meant drinking, but that means like cough syrup and mouthwash and whatever. It says alcohol in any form, and if you attend a book study, you'll hear old-timers talk about that shit. I've had roommates go out on what's called NyQuil, you know, just unaware. They're just doing an innocent thing like taking care of a cold or a flu. They chug that back. They have the phenomenon of craving sets in. They cannot stop. It's that easy. It's that simple. So, you know, whatever's written in this book, I take it pretty seriously. We went to his house that day. I got down on my knees. I took a third step with this man. I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And at that point, it was as I understood God. God, I'm getting so nervous right now. I'm trying to use my fancy book and I can't. Anyways, I took that third step prayer, and at the bottom of that third step, okay, I'm going to find it this time. Right here. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea of voicing it without reservation. So I could have got up there, and instead of doing the third step prayer, I could have said, God, Lord, my name is Fred. I'm dying of untreated alcoholism. Please help me. I'd basically taken a third step. This was only a beginning, though honestly and humbly made an effort, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Next, we launched off on a course of vigorous action, the first step, which is a personal house cleaning. You know, I sat down with that man, and we went through the fourth step. He handed me a notebook and a pen, and I was directed to start writing an inventory. An inventory, it's no big deal. I just started making lists and writing about people, institutions, and principles with whom I was angry. No big deal. That was everybody and everything. You know, it was through that man's direction and this book that I'm sober today. You know, it's just the combination of the two. And he didn't have to tell me this. I read it. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. You don't need to tell me that. That's gnarly. You know, I'm going to take this fourth step to the best of my ability. most important part of the fourth step, you know, it's broken up into three sections. We have the resentments, the fears, and then the sexual conduct. But the most important thing about that resentment list is referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened? Though the situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to discard the other person entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. I did that inventory, and I read that to the man, to this man. That was now the fifth step. I was now in the fifth step of recovery. Let's see what it says. This is perhaps difficult in especially discussing our defects with another person. Let's look at the best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to avoid this humbling experience. Well, it was no big deal. There was 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous laid out for me, and they're all the same. I'm going to do 1 through 12. 1's not harder than 5. 5's not harder than 7. I'm just going to do them all. If this is my path to sobriety, I'm going to take them. It was at this point that another miracle happened. Well, actually, the first miracle happened today. I didn't have to take a drink. Right on. A miracle happened in the fact that I was able to look back across this path that I had crossed through Alcoholics Anonymous and working with this man. And one, I had seen the time that I was able to stay sober was incredible. Well, it was maybe like a month at that time. But I never stayed sober anywhere close to that long, consecutively. The second thing was that I was taking direction. I had asked this man for help, and I had never once turned my back on him. Never. The third thing was that I was directed to get up in the morning to ask for the strength to stay sober. And, you know, ask for it 1,000 times that day if I had to. And when I retired, thank him for another day without a drink. And that's when it occurred to me that I had a God, personal to me, working in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous, at that point, was working. It was working its miracle in my life. I was changing. I was doing things contrary to my belief and my actions. I was asking another man for help. I was sitting down. I was reading. I was making lists. I was making inventory. I was looking deep inside Fred to the things that had caused me these pains. I rolled out of there. I had this little BMW single. I rolled out of there. Those wheels must have been like a foot off the ground. We did 6 and 7. The book doesn't direct us to this, but it says, we emphasize willingness as being indispensable. We are now ready to let God remove from us all things that we have admitted are objectionable. Can he now take them, everyone? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us to be willing. These are the character defects that I harbor and I try to hide. And my sponsor directed me to make a list of them because God already knows what they are. I'm not too clear, but if I look deep inside, I can find that, you know, I'm sarcastic and I'm angry, I'm hostile, I'm jealous, you know, I'm lustful. Any one of these things can cause me to pain. If I'm in pain, it's going to separate me from God. If I'm separated from God, I'm going to drink. When we're ready, we ask our Creator, now that we're willing, that he should have all of me, good and bad. I've made a list of my character assets and also a list of my character defects. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of persons we had harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. Because I have all these people, places, and things written on this four-step inventory, it tells me right here that we already have them. We took it when we made inventory. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. So that's all 8 is. It's making the list. No big deal. Then it says at the bottom, it gives us this little hook. Remember, it was agreed in the beginning we would go to any lengths to have victory over alcohol. So they're coming in there. They're all, hey, you know what? Remember in the beginning when you were like with the piss-soaked trousers and the 5-day beard and shit? You were willing then. What happened now? You got like a month of sobriety under your belt? Oh, all right, see ya. That's what happens. You know, guys, they come in here, they clean up, and, you know, they get some food in their belly, and a lot of times they walk, you know? God bless you. I'll say a prayer. I couldn't do it. You know, it's the lessons that we learn through other people's mistakes. You know, my sponsor told me, he's like, you know what, Fred, you're going to see it 1,000 times. And a guy can ask me for help, and I can give him some help, and I can give him a bed to sleep in, and I can give him some money, and I can maybe help him out with a job. You know, I can give him these things, but I can't give him the willingness to stay sober, and I can't give him a relationship with God. If he is unwilling to work these steps to the best of his ability, which is a footbridge to a relationship with a higher power, he's not going to get it. I can't give him that relationship. The person needs to get the relationship by working the steps. God, that sounds harsh, huh? Okay. So moving on, you know, I made a list of those persons that I'm harmed and I'm willing to make an amends to. And, you know, miracles just keep happening because that's where you're seriously into action. Making lists and reading it to a guy, it seems hard at the time, but then you're pushed out onto the streets and you got to go up to these people, businesses, and make an amends. And at the top of my list, there was this guy that every time that I'd seen, we had a physical confrontation. Every time. It would come down to blows. Every time. Didn't matter. So at this point, I was willing to make an amends to this man. I must have rolled to his house like 3 times, and he wasn't there. This fourth time, I rolled up to his house, and I seen that the front door was open. Oh, shit. You know, I'm getting nervous again. I'm sweating. I'm shaking. And I got my book with me. Thank God I got the book. And I'm looking through here for the third step prayer. I'm trying to look for some type of backing, something to give me some strength. And I flip to this, which happens to be in the ninth step. It says, reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. Oh, my God. And so I'm kind of drawn back, and then it's all, hey, we must not shrink at anything. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'm pumped. And, you know, I rolled up to that man's house, and I'm like, oh, hey, you know, can I talk to you? And he's like, oh, sure, come on in. And, you know, it tells us that sometimes we're making amends to a man who will offer service, and that, you know, years of fighting may wash away in an hour. And that's exactly what happened with this guy. And he was just, you know, at the end, it tells us exactly what to say when we're making amends. We simply tell him that we'll never get over drinking until we've done the utmost to straighten out the past and we have swept off our side of the street. Is there anything I can do to make up the things that I've done to you through my drinking? He's all, you know what? I think you just did. And he was actually offering his services if he could help me. And that's exactly what the book says. I said no. You know, I rolled out of there once again, just having done the gnarliest amends on my list and knowing that I had taken direction from a sponsor and direction out of this book. You know, it was water under the bridge. And it tells us, you know, things aren't always going to go that easy. I've been like, you know, I tried to make an amends after making this one. It wasn't that easy, or it didn't go that smoothly. You know, the guy's like, you know what, Fred, I don't want nothing to do with you. Just, you know, move on. I'm like, all right. I asked my sponsor about it, and he said he directed me back to the book. It's water under the bridge. You know, we were there. We tried to clean off our side of the street. If the guy didn't want nothing to do with me, you know, he's unwilling to listen. He said that I could attempt to see this man again, or I could just keep moving. I kept moving. All right. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. That's what I'm doing. I'm cleaning up the past through my fourth step, looking at myself, 6 and 7, and I'm in 9. I'm cleaning up that past. And this doesn't mean that I'm free from anything. So it's telling me our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. You know, when these things crop up, We continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these things crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. I have a guy, there's a buddy of mine in this room that happens all the time with me. You know, we're getting these little quarrels and these little spats and shit. And within like 10 minutes, you know, we're making a phone call. Hey, you know what? I was wrong. You know, I'm sorry about that. 10th step. These are also known as the maintenance steps. Step 11 suggests that prayer and meditation. you want to read this one? This is Tristan's favorite step. You know, that's what it says. Suggests that prayer and meditation, we shouldn't be shy about this matter of prayer. Better men than us are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague on this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions, okay? So I've just gotten through the day, another day sober, and when we retire at night, we constructively review our day, and it asks us a series of questions. I was directed to answer these questions. You know, it asks us, asks us several questions. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with someone immediately? Now, it's quite similar to 10. Now, the fact of this, it's a catch-all, because I'm at home and I'm alone, and I didn't get a chance to make an amends to that guy throughout the day. So it's telling me to review my day, and it's, oh my God, you know, I punched that guy in the stomach, and then I spit on his car. Hey, bro, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. Can I wash your truck for you? You know, and then it says, after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. Okay, I made it through the day. The next morning, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider the plans for the day before we begin. You know, like, oh my God, I got to get to that office and I got to get that meeting. No. You consider the plans for today. Okay, what's going to happen today? See, we try to get a jump on the day before it gets us. You know, a lot of times we don't know what the day is going to bring, but we try to be mentally and spiritually prepared. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here, we ask God for inspiration and intuitive thought or decision. We relax. Hey, we take it easy. We do not struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. You know, it's all right here. And if you're working with a sponsor who knows this book, then you're on the right path. Then we have the best chapter here, chapter 7, working with others. I've got to sit my ass down here, but God, I think I just nailed it. Perfect, huh? You know, it starts off with the whole chapter is incredible. It tells us exactly what to do when I was that new guy. When I was sitting there sweating and shaking in that man's house, all he did was lay out a kit of spiritual tools for my inspection. And now, after working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm there laying out the tools for another man's inspection. Practical experience shows us that nothing so much as will ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. I think I'm going to close with this. life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Thanks for letting me share.